Welcome, welcome, guys. We are back for another episode of The Lock In. I am joined, as usual, by a freshly sheared, it looks like, Dara O'Carney. Dara, I feel like haircuts or lack thereof get more comments in our YouTube comments than anything else on the show these days.
Yeah, I mean, once my hair gets past a certain length, pretty much all our YouTube comments are the state of O'Carney's hair. that passed long a time ago, actually. I think the audience just kind of gave up. But we were around at my son's place last week with a visiting American, Kevin O'Donnell. Shout out to Kevin. And my wife took some photographs and I was shocked. I mean, my hair was literally standing up, mad professor-like. So I thought, okay, well, maybe it's time to finally get a haircut.
Well, I've done the same this week, Dara. I think it's probably been a couple of months for me as well. So we're looking well groomed today. Without further ado, let's bring in our very special guest this week. It's got to be said, he's a poker player. He's a coach. He is a writer. I'm delighted to say he is also a WSOP bracelet winner. Welcome to the show, Carlos Welch.
Thank you, guys. Thanks for having me.
Look, it's so great to have you on. Let's get right to it. You are the big story of the week. The only story we really care about, to be honest. We're just going to, it's going to be a lot of filler after this. A few days ago, you took down the 888 Crazy Eights WSOP online event, outlasting 781 other players to win yourself $125,000 and a gold bracelet. Carlos, you came into the final table relatively short stacked. You won a very big flip, I know, quite early on with tens against ace queen. Can you give us a quick summary of how things went from there?
That's actually a good question, because my first thought was no, because everything has been a brain fog since then. I do know that at some point I won a big hand calling a 15 big blind jam from the small blind, and I'm in the big blind with ace seven, and I sucked out against ace 10. So that gave me, that kind of built my stack back up, but I couldn't tell you if that was before the final table or not. And then there was another big hand where I opened aces under the gun and someone jabbed like 20, 25 bigs on me with ace king. Once again, stage of the tournament, I know it was in the money. I know it was pretty late, but I don't know at what point of the final table that I build my stack back up from that small stack you saw.
Are you still in the Lucky Hotel room?
I am. I'm in the same building, different room, but same building for sure.
Bigger room, I hope. Bigger room.
No. It's actually smaller. It's actually smaller, which is on brand for me.
Yeah, I mean, I listened to Carlos on the Thinking Poker podcast on my long run today, and it was just after he'd won the bracelet, and he was still moving out of the Rio for the weekend because, you know, the race go up at the weekend. So,
yeah, don't want to give the money back.
Well, Carlos, Dara alluded to it there. I think without even sleeping, you hopped straight onto a call with your good friend Andrew Brokos, good friend of the shows as well, to record a impromptu, I'm guessing, episode of Thinking Poker. Andrew's excitement at the top of that and all the way through really was palpable. I spoke to Dara O'Carney right after he heard your news that morning. It was morning where we were, and I can tell you his excitement was very real as well. In the hours after the result, you tweeted, "The bracelet's pretty cool, I'm going to get this right, and the money's just going to get thrown on the pile, but staying up for 24 plus hours to read all these great comments is priceless." What do you think it is about you that elicits such a genuine, pure, happy-for-you response?
I think everybody just loves the underdog story. A lot of people that's been who followed me kind of know my humble beginnings and how I got to this point and how it wasn't, you know, an easy grind up for me. This is like, you know, a 15-year overnight success. So I think that's something that a lot of people can root for.
Yeah, it certainly is. Dara, we are a cynical pair of old men. But despite that, you have often made the point that WSOP bracelets are a little bit special. They're not like an ordinary trophy. I think you've likened them to Olympic medals at one point too. Can you expound on that?
Yeah, I think, I mean, they are the closest thing we have to Olympic medals. They're clearly the best thing to have. It's still better than winning, you know, a WPT or an EPT. It's it's just given the history of the event, and you know, it's the World Series of Poker, all the best players tend to go there. I mean, there's been talk in recent years about how the number they're giving out devalues them, but I think every poker player would still love to win a Bracelet, at least every tournament player, that is. Returning to why, like, everybody felt so good for Carlos, I think it's sort of, you know, and Andrew alluded to this too in Thinking Poker, that a lot of the time when you hear somebody won, you know, something big, even if you know them pretty well, there's still kind of an element of jealousy or schadenfreude or whatever, but there's none of that with Carlos because he's such a genuine person and also so humble. And the one thing you know is that, like, this isn't going to change Carlos. You know, there's a famous story about an Irish lottery winner once who was asked, is this huge amount of money that you won going to change you? And he said, no, it absolutely won't. And they said, well, what about the begging letters? Because, you know, people who win lotteries, big, large sum of money, suddenly people start writing the begging letters. And he said, oh, don't worry, I'll keep sending them out. in Carlos's case, I think it was like, you know, don't worry, I'll keep checking out of the Rio when I think the price is too high. So this is just a feel-good story all around. I think everybody who knows Carlos knows, first of all, he genuinely deserves it. And secondly, he won't be one of these sad cases that it turns out to be the worst thing that ever happened to him.
Yes. Well, Carlos, turning back to you on this, I noticed, I think it was the next day or maybe 2 days later, you had another deep run. I think you might have bust four tables out. And you have been playing the majority of the online events since then. Have you any sort of expectation to maybe grind a big World Series when it starts proper? Are you gonna maybe travel some? Is there any splurge in there at all?
No, this actually kind of alludes to a comment I wanted to make to what Dar just said, which is a testament to my friends in the poker community that they root for me in spots like this, because unlike other poker players, I'm not going to put the money back into the player pool. So I'm not going to be firing 10Ks. I'm not going to be, you know, playing a big WSOP live schedule. I'm house shopping for my mom.
Aww.
And investing.
Come on. There won't be a dry eye in the house if you keep telling those stories like that. That's a lovely thing to hear.
Yeah, it's true.
Where are you going to buy the house?
In my hometown, I say my mom, and that's Griffin, Georgia. It's close to Atlanta. It's really like, you know, it's like almost for my whole family, because I guess a lot of people's families are like this, but there's usually one person's house who's like, that's like the centerpiece for the entire family if people are still in the same town. And for years, it's been my grandmother's house, but as she's getting older, that's going to kind of transition to my mom. And right now she has kind of a you know, smaller apartment. So I'm hoping to get, you know, a bigger place with some land, so that where, you know, when all my cousins and brothers and other relatives, when, you know, they don't have a place to go, in the past has been go to mama's house, which is what we call my grandmother. My grandmother's nickname is Mama. So everybody would go to Mama's house. And now, you know, I want to have a house like that when my mom becomes like the matriarch.
That's absolutely brilliant. I love that story. Dara, I hate to bring up one of your crossbars, but obviously the closest you ever got to a bracelet was that heads up against Pesh, I want to say maybe 4 or 5 years ago now.
6 years ago, 2015.
Well, you would remember the exact date, I've no doubt. I just wanted to ask you again, just in the context of bracelets, and this is not to take away from Carlos's achievement, because of course we are all overjoyed, but there was a sort of a sense, and I think you did say at one point as well, that like the online bracelets, obviously we kind of have to do them during the pandemic. Live poker's coming back, maybe by September they feel like they can really put on a proper event. But will there be a distinction years from now? Like, I know we feel like it's different now, but like in maybe 10 years time, will people even have a sense, do you think?
I think it very much depends on who the person is, to be honest. given that it's Carlos, like, I literally don't give a shit that it was on. the idea of Carlos with a bracelet is so wonderful that there's no asterisk beside the bracelet in my mind. It's just Carlos has a bracelet, and that's an incredible story. You know, if it's some guy I don't particularly like, yeah, whatever. But I think this is one for the good guys. So yeah, we're definitely claiming this one. All the other online bracelets are probably devalued, but this was the 888. That's really the special one.
It was a special one. It looked kind of fancy.
It's the crazy eights. Like, it's got the coolest name. He knocked Negreanu out along the way. So, like, you know, greatest player of all time got knocked out by Carlos. So everything about it says that this bracelet is magical. This is actually the best bracelet ever. This is better than the main event bracelets in my mind.
did you catch that? This I won this crazy eight almost exactly 8 days at 8 years after my first appearance on the Thinking Poker podcast.
Yeah, I caught that. Yeah, that was pretty, yeah. Again, and that's pretty. But that was your first splash in the poker world. So yeah. It's just a fairy tale story, basically. I did hear you complaining on the latest Thinking Poker about how little coverage you were initially getting from Poker News, that you had to win the damn thing to even get mentioned.
Yeah.
It was a major oversight by Poker News.
Yeah. In the hand where I knocked out Negreanu, they gave the guy sitting on my left the credit for it in the update. And I was like, hey, I'm a Poker News writer. Like, you guys know me. Show me some love.
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, look, you know, I'm having flashbacks now to the very first time you were on this show, which I want to say was like, maybe almost like 4 years ago, definitely 3 years ago. And I remember you like giving tips about like how to save money in the Rio. Don't use the oxygen, bring your own water. So like it has been, as you said, like a fairy tale story. And you go back 8 years even further. I know you're a substitute teacher. You know, probably wouldn't have made any, you know, big claims to professionalism at the very beginning. Give us a little sense of that journey, because I think maybe some people don't know you as well as we do, maybe didn't hear that interview, maybe don't listen to Thinking Poker, although you should because it's a great podcast. But could you give us a little, maybe a few beats of that journey?
So I guess I'll try to summarize this quickly. I grew up, like I said, in the Atlanta, Georgia area. Grew up pretty poor and was a pretty good student in school. So I kind of like worked my way up and started, you know, having some moderate financial success for myself. Eventually graduated college, became a math teacher. And somewhere along the way, I found poker. And I found poker because, like I said, growing up poor, I was always looking for ways out of poverty. And I used to mess around with these get rich quick schemes that you see the late night infomercials. Lost a lot of money doing certain things when I was probably 17, 18 years old. And then one night I was watching and they said this guy named Moneymaker won a bunch of money. And I'm thinking, like, who writes this shit? Like, this is like, obviously this one's a scam. I'm not falling for that. but I gave it, you know, I did a little research and I was like, wait, this is real? And so I was like, okay, this is going to be my quote unquote get rich scheme that started me down that rabbit hole. And so started playing online around 2004. And then sit and goes primarily up until Black Friday. Obviously, that was like, you know, a disaster for a lot of us in the U.S. So I was out for like a year. And then these rogue U.S. sites started to pop up that you can play on. And so I kind of got back in. And at that time, the sit and goes were kind of dead. So that started me on the tournaments. And so this was around 2012. And then in 2013, I was a member of Tournament Poker Edge, and Andrew Brokus is one of the pros on that site. And so that's how I met Andrew and met up with him for the first time in person in Vegas in 2013 to get on the podcast. And I think, you know, pretty much the rest is history from there.
Well, it's a wonderful story. With I suppose you can say it's a happy ending, but you know, you only kind of say happy endings because you choose to decide when things stop. Your life goes on. Maybe there'll be a second bracelet in a few weeks' time. I wouldn't be surprised. I could talk about this, Dara. I know you could too, but we have to move on to some far lesser stories, frankly. Landon Tice quit his game against Bill Perkins. That was a couple of weeks ago. It actually happened just after we dropped the last episode, but it still falls within the fortnight of stuff we cover here. Landon threw in the towel in his heads up challenge after only 4,900 hands out of the 20,000 hands playing 200-400. Tice's team decided, I guess, that he couldn't overcome the 9 big blind handicap given to Perkins. But what was kind of unusual was about 800 or 900 hands previously, he wasn't far off pace. Swings are pretty common. There's going to be variance in that format, of course. We saw lots of it in the Negreanu Polk match several months ago. So it was strange for it to kind of have the plug pulled so quickly. But obviously his backers, and he was substantially backed, decided it just wasn't a profitable venture anymore and, you know, found some get-out clause, I guess, or I suppose they always had the option to stop. Many in the poker community were very critical of Landon. I guess they should be critical of Landon and his team, but Landon took the brunt of it, I think, and I know was very downcast and posted that video to Twitter that I'm sure a lot of people saw. It was very hard not to feel a lot of sympathy for him. He was obviously finding it quite tough. Dara, I know you saw that video. What did you make of it?
Yeah, I think he did take it quite tough. He's a young guy, and to be honest, the criticism was very, very unfair, in my opinion. Clearly, he had the pull plugged on him by his backers, which is they're obviously completely within their rights to do. But a lot of the speculation afterwards, you know, about what the reasons might have been beyond the fact that he'd fallen behind the pace required seemed unnecessary. It seemed to be one of those cases to me where a certain amount of resentment or jealousy had built up towards Landon, given how quickly he had sort of been thrust into the limelight. So people were sort of waiting for an opportunity to, you know, clip his heels, as it were. We in Ireland are very familiar with that that particular form of begrudgery, as it's known. Different cultures have different names for it. I think the Aussies refer to it as tall poppy syndrome, where the tall poppies are the ones that get cut down the first. I guess it's a human instinct, but it's not a particularly nice one. Landon is a young guy. I know from talking to people in his circle that he has always worked very, very hard at his game. He's not all bluster and hype, as a lot of people tried to suggest afterwards. So I felt it was unfair. I think he will come through this fine because he's a young guy and he's very resilient. This is essentially a character test. The other thing I would say that jumps out for me is the whole culture of poker is different now from when we started. You know, back when we started, staking was barely a thing. So everybody just kind of ground up themselves. Now people are sort of going around looking to get back in deals and staking deals, and they kind of only focus on the positives a lot, thinking, well, I'm going to be able to play high, et cetera, et cetera. But obviously the problem is once you do get backed or staked, then you're essentially handing over control to whoever the money is coming from. And that's clearly what happened here. I mean, if Landon had, you know, been playing all in his own money, I have no doubt he would have gone right till the end. But he essentially had to pull the plug pulled because he was backed.
Yeah, 100%. I actually had a quick chat with Matt Berkey, who was one of his backers, I think actually on this challenge, one of his minor backers. And Matt said he had most of his action in the outcome of the match sort of scenario. So he was certainly financially invested in it continuing because it was the only way he could win. But he said that Landon absolutely would have gone on. He actually feels like Landon would have gone on even in a hopeless cause, just thinking it was a good character building exercise. And, you know, he would learn an awful lot along the way through, you know, the study, the routine, the experience of maybe being down and out, but still having to fight on. I also want to push back on one story that kind of went around because there was a bit of a media pile on, and I want to get your take on this in a moment, Carlos. But we approached Landon to be on our podcast, and I know two other podcasts who approached Landon and said, come on our podcast. Landon wasn't seeking out podcast exposure and whatever 3 months ago, 4 months ago, in the way that people feel. He was somebody that was in the news. He's an interesting story. He's a, you know, young, bright, shining star. And people like us will hear that story and think, well, that's a good story. We should put that on the show. And we and many others did that. But he wasn't like knocking on our door. We were knocking on his. And I imagine even just from the interactions we had before and during that interview, he was quite reticent. He wasn't like we were dragging him in there, really, to be honest. So some claims that people made that he was sort of like basking in the limelight and doing photo shoots and going on podcasts, I thought was very, very harsh. Carlos, what do you make of the general pylon culture we see? Not just in poker, I guess it's sort of all over. Social media amplifies everything. But when it sort of, you know, comes down so hard on an individual like this.
I would guess that this is indicative of his desire to be one of the bigger names in poker, not necessarily named, but one of the better players. Is like, I think that does kind of breed jealousy. Like when you're like, you know, fighting to be, you know, top of the heap. And I think people love to see people like that fall. Now, I personally never wanted to be that type of player because I know the amount of work it takes to get there. And I'm kind of lazy. So I think a guy like Landon, who is putting in the work, had a lot of success early and started to approach, you know, the stratosphere as far as like, you know, the better players in the game. When that doesn't work out, a lot of people kind of, that's where the pylon comes from, I think.
Yeah, that's a great take. Well, look, Tice is back on the MTT felt. He's playing online. I imagine he's going to play some live. He's back to winning ways too. He got second in an MTT for 20K or so last night. Bill Perkins could not resist. He couldn't miss a beat. There. He stayed in there to say, second, Landon, how well, you know, heads up is tough, which I enjoyed. And I know Landon enjoyed as well. He was laughing along. But it's, obviously you wish him well. You want to see him, you know, maybe get to a place where he's not backed, you know, in the near future. And as Dara, you know, pointed out, when you get to that place, if that's a place you so desire to, you get a lot more freedom and a lot more choice in, you know, maybe your career path as well. So best of luck to him.
One final thing before we move on from that, he is lucky that he was playing against Bill Perkins as well, because, you know, Perkins is one of the classier people who is not going to rub it in his face. So, you know, we have seen other heads up battles get a lot more acrimonious and ugly and people throwing insults at each other. Perkins is not that kind of guy. Shout out to Bill Perkins as well.
Mm. Yes.
Well, one of the people who did join in the pylon, obviously, maybe was one of the main instigators, was Jason Moe. And Jason went off to Doug Polk, his good friend, to be on his first podcast back, I suppose you could put it that way. Doug Polk is back on the airwaves and he has put out a podcast with Jason Moe, with Kevin Rabichow, who was Tice's main coach. I think there was a few coaches in the mix, but I think you could call him his main coach, and Bill Perkins himself. So that was quite an interesting show. I did get a chance to watch it, see it from a few different angles. But I suppose the big story around that, in a way, and we're going to move maybe gentle segue over to the fact that Doug Polk is back on the airwaves. He put out a poker news episode, very much akin to the format he sort of created, I guess, himself and Thomas Keeling and maybe Jamie in there as well with the jokes. They sort of put together a very tongue-in-cheek, funny approach to how to present poker news. And that show is back. And I suppose you could say the podcast is something that Doug wants to take in a different direction. Maybe he doesn't want to stick to just poker. He wants to do some crypto, wants to maybe topically or thematically pull out, you know, ideas of the day and cover those. Dara, how do you feel about Doug muscling in on our podcast territory?
I take it as a huge compliment. I think a few years ago, people thought that podcasts were like the ugly cousin of vlogs or other forms of content, or Twitch, the other forms of content were something. But I think the pandemic has proven that there's a huge demand out there for podcasts. And, you know, you know you're in a fashionable niche when Doug is looking to muscle in his in his vest. And it's so, yeah, I mean, I think it's good. I've always championed other podcasts that I like because I don't see them as really competitors. I think, you know, people can listen to more than one podcast. And if there are lots of good podcasts out there in the poker space, that's actually good for poker podcasts in general.
There's only two globally recognized podcasts, though, Dara. You only have two choices.
Are we going back to the award again? Yeah. clearly the only yardstick is the Global Poker Awards.
I think so. It's a bit like having a bracelet, Dara. When you have one, it's like, you know, it's just the people who have it.
It's over there gathering dust in my bookshelf. So it's vastly important to us. But yeah, but I mean, Doug has had this love-hate relationship with poker and with poker content creation down the years. You know, he keeps telling us he's out and then he comes back in. It'll be interesting to see how long this lasts. He's obviously a man of very diverse interests. At the moment, I guess there's nothing that he thinks he could be doing much better than poker content creation, and that's definitely good for poker. He kickstarted poker on YouTube in my mind. His hand breakdowns really brought it to a new level, both in terms of the audience that they got and just the impact that they had, and how much they proved that YouTube was actually a good promotional platform for poker. So it's definitely great to see him back in the mix. And I think it's good for all of us, really.
Yeah, I agree. I think it is good for all of us because I think competition is good. I think just, you know, good quality stuff in the space brings people to the space. And I think when you look at it at the moment across the landscape, a lot of the podcasts have sort of drifted away. I don't know if that's a summer thing. Maybe it's a summer thing. But like you and I were commenting the other day that quite a few of the shows we like I've stopped making as many shows. There's Brad is still kind of pumping out
five a week. I think about half the poker podcasts that come out every week are Brad. So
yeah, that's true. I think that is true. You've been on Brad's podcast, Carlos.
Yeah, how was that experience? Times. Awesome, man. Brad's a great guy.
Yeah, no, Brad is a great guy. I think everybody in the poker world has been on Brad about seven times now. So he absolutely churns it out. Like he's ahead of all of us and he only started about 15 months ago. So it's just insane, his output.
Yeah, it really is. Well, look, the other show that Doug is putting out there is a familiar show to people. And I suppose it was his most popular show. Although I actually spoke to Doug about two nights ago and he was saying to me how he just really, really doesn't want to do any hand breakdowns anymore. He is preparing some hand material for his Upswing Lab, which I think he's going to launch. He's going to have a lot of the Negreanu grudge match content in there. And I guess that's monetized and that's his business model. So I suppose that's him getting back to work. But when it comes to just like making those videos where I suppose by his own admission, it was like, how do you play or misplay jacks all the time? He just has no love for that anymore. So I think maybe coming at the news from a satirical point of view suits him, and the podcast maybe is where long form he can flex in different directions. And we wish him all the best with that. The one thing I want to point out before I leave this is he did put out a very clickbaity thumbnail and headline, I suppose, about how Negreanu has not won in 8 years and not won at home in 11 years. Got to say, I think he wrote, like, we've been saying this for 2 months now. So, I, you know, Thomas Keeling on the last show said that we were in danger of burying the lead. We led with this quite a bit before the people. But I think Doug jinxed it, didn't he, Dara?
It's definitely not us, because we have probably mentioned the Negreanu streak in every piece of content that we've made for the last few months.
He spoiled it. He ruined everything. He got his big mouth, his big blower, his big thumbnail artist to make that. And now we all look stupid 2 days
later. I'm almost happy that Negreanu won, just so we don't have to hear about this story anymore, about this streak. As somebody who's had a few streaks myself, I did find myself feeling a bit of sympathy for him, which I never expected to feel for, you know, middle-aged multimillionaire Daniel Negreanu. But yeah, I mean, it was funny while it lasted, but I think maybe the joke was what went on just a little bit too long.
I was okay with the joke going a little longer, I'll be honest. Daniel, as we've alluded to there, did manage to last the longest in a small runner field. I think there was maybe 20 something uniques, 35 entrants total. He took down the 50K Poker Go Cup. We're going to talk a little bit about Poker Go again later in the show. But in this one, he did manage to take down the tournament. And he jumped straight into the 100K, which is actually going on right now this minute. They're down to five, which I think is the bubble, because the 100K only got like 20 runners or something like that. Third place will actually win him the series trophy. I feel so dirty mentioning these positive Nagrani results right now, but I do feel like you, Darrell. I did a lot of laughing at his expense during the losing streak, so it's probably only fair.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Well, look, we will move on. Carlos, I'm really keen to get your take on the next story, because I actually think you might have a fresh take on this, because Darren and I kind of have spoken about this at different points over the last few months. I want to say even 6 months ago, maybe we talked about it, but it's back in the news now. Olivier Bousquet sort of pointed some fingers at Nagranu and Polk in trying to make his point. A little while ago, he jumped on Twitter and he said, not to make this personal, but I was absolutely floored by Doug Polk and Daniel Nagrano even discussing the possibility of using pre-flop charts, not because it's cheating if they agree, they can agree to whatever they want, but because of how incredibly and profoundly lazy it is. He added, imagine a chess match between two super GMs where they agree to use an engine for the first eight moves because they don't want to spend time memorizing openings. The entire idea is so preposterous to me. I suppose the story here, before I give Polk's reaction, Carlos, is that charts are bad or charts are cheating, sort of. I guess cheating if both people aren't agreeing, which is like most of the time when we're playing poker, we're not making special agreements with whoever's on the other side of the computer.
I don't know, man. This topic has always been a slippery slope. I can remember in the sit and go days, which is where I started, there were, like, it was very common for people to have, like, you know, preflop charts taped to their wall. And I don't recall the majority of people having a problem with it back then. I think the problem now is that with the advent of solvers, we get more than just push-fold information, where now you see, okay, what ranges do you defend versus various three bets and, you know, squeezes and all that kind of stuff, which, like, the charts are starting to improve to the point where they're starting to approach RTA. So I understand where Olivier is coming from. But again, it's a slippery slope. Like, this conversation has revolved around the use of HUDs in the past as well. And my take on it is, like when he says it's lazy and compares it to grandmaster chess players, it kind of gets back to my take on the Landon Tice story. The reason everybody's, you know, piling on him is because he's trying to approach that grandmaster level, where if you have someone like me who just, you know, came up in poverty and they're trying to, poker is a money making tool, I don't think you would give that type of guy crap for using preflop charts or a HUD. But when you're trying to, you know, reach the sky like Icarus, you know, people are waiting for your wings to melt. And so I think a little bit of that is here when you're looking at two high level players with Nagrandu and Polk. I can understand that side of Olivier's take as well.
Yeah, good point. Well, Polk replied that it got a little feisty. He said, why do you make such ridiculously aggro statements like this on Twitter? I don't get it. The two guys are friends, so they could have had this in private.
Yeah.
In real life, you're a totally different person. Poker is difficult, and you only get so many hours to study by having pre-flop sheets. You can spend more of your time focusing on playing post-flop. Is he right, Dara?
I mean, this is one of those things. There's really no right or wrong. It's just what everybody agrees is cheating or not. The one thing I would say, and this kind of echoes what Carlos said, is that when I coach relative beginners and I explain preflop ranges to them and show them various charts, they all just assume they can use them online, and they don't see that as cheating. You know, because it's relatively simple information. Yes, they could memorize it. That seems kind of pointless, really, to be honest. And they don't, you know, the it obviously gives them an edge, but the game's still mostly post-flop. So certainly most recreations I know don't see it as cheating, which is actually, you know, a lot of them take a much dimmer view of HUDs, for example, which Carlos also mentioned. A lot of them do see HUDs as cheating. So I think this is kind of a storm in a teacup, really. It's not something that, as I said, relative beginners would see as cheating. So why are we focusing so much on it? Much more concerned about post-flop RTA, people having complete solutions and that they can access quickly in real time. That seems a much bigger concern. The sites even generally take a fairly benevolent view towards pre-flop charts. I think Stars actually say that certainly there's nothing wrong with a raise first in chart, where if everybody's folded to you, it's okay to look at a chart and to see whether you're supposed to open your hand or not. One of the big problems as well with saying that it would be cheating is you're basically trying to police something which can't be policed. If people have charts on their wall, like, what are you going to do? Install 360 degree cameras to make sure that nobody's looking at charts while they're playing? And in that situation, you know, some people might then stop using charts, but then they're at a disadvantage to people who are using charts. It seems better to just create the level playing pitch by saying, look, pre-flop charts are fine.
Yeah, as you said to me once before, I might be paraphrasing with my example, but like, if you just had something written on your hand saying, fold ace queen pre-flop, don't be a noob, technically you've brought in a little cheat sheet there as well. So, you know, like, you know, as you say, it's degrees, of course. But policeability is certainly really important. You mentioned PokerStars rules there, and actually so did Polk. And I'm going to read out one of them. This actually was a rule instigated in 2015. So it's an old rule and it's still there on the books. In the past, we had always allowed charts to be used for reference during play. A primary reason was that a player could simply print out a chart and we would not be able to detect it. Another was that the charts in use were limited in their impact on the game. Detailed charts that were complex enough to provide advice, useful enough to be competitive against capable players, were very limited in the breadth of situations covered. Such a push-fold Nash chart for heads-up play. Any charts covering the game more comprehensively, such as hand grouping charts with basic strategy, were not complex enough to cause an issue for game integrity. Liv replied to him sort of with similar info, if you like. It was a PokerStars terms of service point. He said, prohibited at all times, and this is written in PokerStars terms of service, any tool or service that plays without human intervention, a bot, or reduces the requirement of a human to make decisions. A human must decide what action to take and the exact relative size of any bet or raise. Now, a chart's obviously influencing that, but the person's still pressing the button, and that's kind of the key point there, I suppose. And maybe that would have been a good counterpoint for Polk. Whether, you know, Olivier made any headway with Doug, we don't know yet, but actually at the moment, literally as we were just going live, I spotted that that podcast has gone live. Doug has actually done a podcast with Olivier. I spoke to Olivier, who told me he recorded this with Doug yesterday, and Olivier said to me that they were on good terms at the end. Here it is, actually. He says, I wrote it down. Both apologize. So he said, we both apologize for overdoing it on Twitter and mostly agree on bigger issues. He said that they had a pretty constructive talk. So we're checking that podcast out. It could be a good topic and it will probably go into a lot more detail than we had time for. Now, here's the story I kind of really want to get into the most. And it might be the one that you really don't, Dara. And maybe Carlos, I'd like to hear your take as well. Or this is you're going to have to indulge me mostly on this one. Poker Go copyright claims. Okay, so this actually does affect us directly as a story. People mightn't be aware of why, and Dara, you know why, because this is several months ago. But PokerGo are bringing the hammer right now on a number of content creators in the space who have, in their opinions, violated copyright on their material. As I said, it's worth noting that two of our strategy videos going back, I think one of them was like 3 years old and one of them was a year old, got pulled.
I think it was actually three, David, but we remade one without using their footage.
Oh, you're right. They did pull three and we did decide to remake one because it was a particularly successful one for us. That's right. I remember that. But yes, indeed. So we got three pulled. We were also given a strike against us on our YouTube channel. And when you get a strike against you, it's kind of like three strikes and you're out. So you don't really don't want to get a second strike because then you're on tender hooks as a content creator. Other people have had that happen to them and it's devastating.
Yeah, again, this is a minor point, but my memory is that they only objected to one of our videos, but we were told we had a strike against us and we were afraid because the other two videos also used Poker Go material that they would then object to them and they would count as a second or third strike. So we preemptively took the decision to pull those other videos as well.
You're absolutely right. And I am misremembering it. And you're telling the story better than me because that is actually exactly how it happened. But it, as you say, like it just puts you on tender hooks. I remember what happened was we were given a strike and then they said, do you want to appeal against it? Now, like, yeah, you do want to appeal against it because, you know, on the grounds of fair use, I think you have a case. But the alternative was, do you want to go to school? And Darry, you didn't have to do this. I had to fucking do this. This was like fucking ridiculous. I had to like fill out a form that I thought was going to be like four questions. It was about fucking 300 questions asking me, what would you do in this copyright scenario? What would you do? I'm pretty sure I got half them wrong, to be honest, because it was fucking hard. But you had to sort of like answer the questions and do your homework. And then they were like, okay, now we'll probably take the strike away from your channel because you've kind of gone through the sort of tuition or whatever it was. So I took that. I took it for the team, Darry. I took that one for the team because I didn't want our.
Glad to hear it.
I didn't want our lovely strategy videos going down. But look, this is what I want to get your take on, Carlos, because again, it'll be a fresh one. I know what Darry thinks of this one. Fair use is defined as per US copyright law as the doctrine that excerpts of copyright material may, under certain circumstances, be quoted verbatim for purposes such as criticism, news reporting, teaching, and research without the need for permission or payment to the copyright holder. Now, in my book, Poker Instructional Videos clearly falls under the category of teaching, could also maybe fall under the category of criticism. What say you?
I agree. That definition seems clear cut to me. I don't really understand how PokerGo has a case here based off of that definition. I guess it's just, you know, power of the purse.
Yeah, and I think it also almost is like the big company coming after the smaller content creator and you just get fucking intimidated and you're like, oh shit, are they going to pull the whole plug? Like, yeah, they might pull the channel down, but maybe we get to appeal, but like in the meantime, we've no channel and you don't want that to happen. Darry, what's your take on what people of our size, like sort of medium-sized poker content creators, you know, we're smaller than Doug, but then they've attacked smaller guys too.
Yeah, I don't really understand the rationale. I mean, I do think they are basically trying to bully you in. They're more or less, they probably know that they have very little leg to stand on, that if it actually went to a court of law, you would win under fair usage. But they also know that somebody like us doesn't want to go to that hassle. We don't have a team of lawyers who are standing by to go in and argue our case for our videos that got 2,000 or 3,000 views on YouTube. It just seems very, very petty. Other providers take a different approach. I remember talking to the people behind Poker Night in America when we had to pull the PokerGo videos because we actually had, I think we might have had a video that used Poker Night in America footage too, and I was worried that that might be an issue. And they said, it's absolutely not an issue. Use anything you want. We will facilitate it in any way we can. We see it as very much as a positive. You're bringing fresh eyes to our content, and you're also adding value in the form of the analysis. I think that's a much more sensible approach because at the end of the day, everybody benefits from more eyes on poker and people also adding value to existing content. I understand that PokerGo is behind a paywall and therefore they want to protect their copyrights, but this doesn't seem like it's great to do that. I mean, it's almost like a free advertisement for them. If somebody really likes the footage that they see on the YouTube channel and decides, oh, I want to see more of this, surely that has to be good for them rather than bad. I'm kind of reminded of when my first book was coming out and I was talking to Barry about issues about it being pirated. And Barry said, don't worry about it because the type of people who steal a book are not going to buy a book. You're not really losing anything. Okay, they get to read the book for free, which is kind of annoying, but it's not actually costing you sales. I think the same is true in this case. I don't think they're losing subscribers just because other YouTube channels, including our channel, sometimes uses some of their footage for hand breakdowns, etc.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, this story sort of gained fresh traction a couple of weeks ago after Susan Ettery, better known maybe as Poker Susie to people on Twitter, had her channel taken down. And she is a poker fan, pure and simple. And you're not talking about someone who is monetizing anything. In the case of Susan, I think she basically sort of splices clips together, sort of makes little summary videos, almost doing some work for them, frankly. And any traction she would have got with those would probably have enticed people to want to go behind the paywall, if anything. Now, what I would say is maybe her rendering is closer to something that they could claim is copyright infringement. She maybe wasn't doctoring it or using the footage to add enough to it or to make it different enough. I think maybe they would have had a better case against her, but I don't think that's the fucking point. I think that it, you know, clearly the hard work of a fan doing something like that, who's not trying to make money off it, is not trying to do anything other than maybe, you know, make nice clips that her friends might enjoy or that like her followers on Twitter might enjoy. Carlos, like, what is the alternative? Like, obviously the alternative is at some level, PokerGo and Poker Central, like, being cooler about these things, but like, is there a downside for them if they were that way?
Carlos is frozen.
Carlos is extremely
Carlos is tanking
on our screen. Yeah, probably not seeing because he is literally frozen in time right now.
And he's one of the hardest men to. There we go,
Carlos. He's back.
We thought you were tanking, Carlos.
I'll tell you what happened. So I'm here at the Rio, and when you check in, you can use the internet for 24 hours.
Oh yeah, I remember that.
Every day you have to re-sign in. So I must have checked in on Sunday roughly at this time. But we're back now. So the alternative to allowing smaller content creators to use content, I guess people may have to start using these third-party programs that allow you to input hand data and like show the hand using graphics as opposed to using video. Like I know you guys do it often with the hands that you put out. So I guess a lot of content creators may have to start going that route.
Yeah,
I agree on that. In fact, I've forgotten my point now. David, you were going to say something.
No, I was going to support what Carla said there. We obviously do a kind of a tricksy thing there. It sort of suits us in a way because it allows us to advertise Unibet a little bit more. We use their artwork, if you like, their tables and things like that. And you know, that's obviously something our sponsor enjoys. But there is times where maybe, you know, it's a live read or it's a, you know, there's a time where you're kind of like, oh, if you could only see his face, and we literally can't fucking show the face because these fuckers might like send their lawyers after us. And as Dara pointed out, we actually do have a very strong legal team, but we have to keep them, you know, protected us in loads of other ways because copyright's the least of our problems on this show when we're getting as far up to the line as we do and fire as many shots as we do. We need to keep them, you know, working on, you know, keeping those people at bay.
Yeah, I do remember as well that I used to have a PokerGo subscription. I was trying to remember the other day why I cancelled it. And I remember I actually cancelled it in a fit of pique when they made us take those videos down. So I think it can piss people off too. I've spoke to a few people who were very pissed off about the story that you just mentioned, that lady being forced to take her stuff down. It does seem ridiculously petty. And a few people said to me they were going to cancel their PokerGo subscriptions. So that's the only way you're actually going to change it, if you actually hurt them, hurt their bottom line.
Yeah. Okay, finally, some late breaking news. This just broke today, although Carlos told us off camera just before this started, he actually found out about it yesterday. But the 2+2 forum has been sold. Now, that maybe comes with the whole kit and caboodle here. Carlos may be able to tell us more, but from what I read and what I found out about just before we came on air, posting on the Dublas 2 forum, Mason said that it was being sold to the same people who have brought you the Hand to Note Hood. Apparently those guys are quite active on the forum anyway, so they're familiar to a lot of the people and they're very good technologically. And he felt like, well, you know, they'd be good for taking it on. In a statement about the sale, Mason said, our reasons for selling at this time is simply that those of us, including myself, who run the site, are getting old. And I'll be 70 this fall. So when the offer came in to sell the site to new, younger people who are on top of the latest programming technology and who would have the ability to make the site better than it ever was, we felt that the time was right and it would be best for everyone, including those of you who are members of the community. Carlos, it had some knock-on effects that you might be able to tell us about.
Yeah, I got fired today. Good thing, you know, I won a bracelet last week. So I've been a writer for 2+2 magazine for 8 years. Our mutual friend, Andrew Brokers, has been writing for almost twice as long, if not more. And we just got a notice today that in addition to the new owners, the new owners definitely now are going to control the forums, but there was this question that you guys posed to me before we recorded if as to whether or not that would affect other parts of 2+2's business. And I can report that the magazine is definitely being discontinued effective immediately. I'm unsure about the books that they do. I'm not sure what's going to happen with that, but I do know that in addition to the forums, the magazine is no longer as well.
Mm-hmm. Mason is so hands-on when it comes to the books. I know he sort of sub-edits almost everything himself, or at least if he's not the main guy, everything sort of passes him by and he sort of gets a look at anything that they put out. So I wonder if maybe in an effort to sort of make his life simpler by getting rid of the forum, he could kind of keep on doing those kind of things because he obviously loves writing himself and maybe he loves editing. Or if this is a complete breakaway now, he just published a book only a couple of months ago about running a good poker room. We were actually thinking of having him on in the near future to maybe discuss that. And I wonder what's next for him. He says he's 70, but you know, there's life in the dog. Dara, what did you make of this story?
Yeah, I think it's... on the face of it, it seems...
Has Dara gone frozen now, or is it me?
Really, have I frozen?
I think it's him.
I think it's you, actually, David. Yeah, you're frozen. So I'm gonna plow on. I think it's actually a sensible decision. I think we all kind of know sometimes that we've just gone a little bit too old for the role we've done. Mason has been an absolute giant in poker. I mean, 2+2 has been so important to the development of online poker. The forums, we've talked quite a bit on this about Thinking Poker, and I believe Nate and Andrew actually mentioned the 2+2 forums. A lot of people did back in the day. It was a real vibrant source of sort of strategy and everything else. David, it was you, so...
It was me. I'm sorry, guys. A lot of tech issues today. Dara, you're probably midway through your answer.
I was midway through my answer, yeah. As for what's next for Mason, I'm sure he's going to stay active. He's still a very sharp guy. We've had him on the show before, very much on point. We're going to get him on the show fairly soon to talk about his latest book as well. He's also been a friend of the podcast. He allowed us to set up a thread there on his on 2+2, which was very helpful. So yeah, I mean, it's always sad to see somebody bowing out, but I do think he's probably timed it very well. Mason's a very smart guy. He's made the right moves at all the right times. And I think this is probably just the latest case of his timing being very good.
Yeah, a huge contributor to poker over a long, long period of time. And, you know, we obviously wish him well, whatever he plans to do next. If that's sort of semi-retirement or full retirement, good luck to him. He deserves it. Carlos, on that note, it has been absolutely lovely to have you on, particularly at such a special time. You were on our list of people to have on this very show, but it became very much prescient that we should have you on this very week rather than maybe in a month's time or whenever it would have been. Any final thoughts as you enter into, you know, what is going to be another few weeks of WSOP online?
Yeah, don't forget to plug all the stuff you need to plug, Carlos.
Okay. Now's the time.
Yeah, so plugs, I would say Thinking Poker Daily, which is a strategy segment we host on patreon.com, where myself, Andrew Brokus, and Nate Mavis discuss strategy hands sent in by subscribers 5 days a week. So there's that. There's the Exploding Small Stakes Tournaments video hand history review at Andrew's store, knitcast.com, where I actually coach my coach, Andrew, on how to win in softer games that I have more experience in, given that he's a higher stakes player. And that, like I said, is a hand history review. And that same concept was done by myself and Alexander Fitzgerald, Assassinato, in classroom form on his website, pokerheadrush.com, and also his Gumroad store. You can get access to that one. That one's called How to Obliterate Passive Tournaments. So those are the plugs. And my final thought is, will I get one of those cool prison drawings that I see on this show?
I actually saw it before we started and I thought, wow, that's the coolest one yet.
Yeah, I can't wait to see it.
Pretty well, everyone's seen it already, so this is just for you, Carlos.
Oh, that is cool.
It's the thumbnail on the video.
You look seriously badass there.
Yeah, that's the only time I'll ever be behind bars, so it's kind of cool to see it.
Carlos Welsh, it has been so lovely to have you on. We wish you all the best with the rest of the World Series online. Maybe a second bracelet. Definitely want to maybe send us a photo when you got that thing, when you got that bad boy on your wrist. We want to see it. Dara O'Kearney, thank you as always. You're looking very dapper tonight. That's it from us. We will be back in 2 more weeks with another lock-in, and we will be back next week with another episode of The Chip Race. Check them out.